listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time till noon, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Today, I'm really happy to have in studio Sari Shepherd. Sari is a PhD. She is a local psychologist, and she has written a book called Questions and Answers about Anorexia Nervosa. Now, this is a subject, although I've read the book a little bit, it's not a subject that I personally know a lot about, which I guess is probably good. I know that we have run into it from time to time with some of the kids that we have transported, but for the most part, we've only been given instructions kind of on what to do over a very short period of time. What we haven't dealt with is what they're going through or what it is that needs to be done for a longer period of time or what maybe parents can do if their child is going through this. So, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan. It's great to be here.
Well, it is very good to have you. And for those that listen, they may know that lots of times I'm getting call-in guests, and I get a little lonely in here sometimes. So... and I think they can pick it up. So I'm glad to have you in here. It certainly feels good to have a smiling face sitting across from me.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, first, I guess for myself and for the listeners, what is anorexia nervosa?
Anorexia nervosa is one of the two major forms of an eating disorder. Now, eating disorders people might be familiar with because we hear a lot about it, especially in the media. We see girls that are very thin. We read about people who struggle with their weight, and sometimes weight struggles are related to an eating disorder. But there are two main types. One is anorexia, and the other is bulimia. And so people might know the names, but not know exactly what they are. And anorexia is an eating disorder that's characterized by a substantial amount of weight loss mm-hmm. and a disturbance in eating behavior. Usually what we see with anorexia is people self-imposed starvation, where they mm-hmm. severely restrict their calories and they lose a lot of weight. And they also engage in other forms of behaviors that help to compensate for the calories they consume. Sometimes they engage in self-induced vomiting, laxative abuse, excessive exercise, anything sort of to keep that weight down.
Now you're saying this in regards to anorexia. Now I have heard in regards to bulimia, I thought that was the one that's the self-induced throwing up.
And that's actually a common misconception. But with anorexia, we see sometimes the very same symptoms as we do with bulimia. But what the difference is between those two disorders, the main difference, is the amount of weight that a person loses. So a person with bulimia will stay more at a normal weight, sometimes mm-hmm. a little bit above a normal weight. But a person with anorexia, even if they have the same symptoms, will end up with less than 85% of their expected weight. So they're the ones that lose the significant amount of weight.
Okay, now tell me what a significant amount is, or is it based more on percentages?
You know, diagnostically, it's based on percentages, where someone who is more than 85% of their expected weight would not be diagnosed with anorexia. They would be diagnosed with bulimia. But someone who weighs less than what's expected of them, 85% or less of what's expected of their weight, would be diagnosed with anorexia.
Right. So in other words, if we have a young girl in high school that... based on her height, she should be 100 pounds. If she's 85, she qualifies.
Exactly. And sometimes if you're right on the border there, the diagnostic implications can be a little bit tricky, but a mental health worker or a physician will just look at other characteristics to see what's the most appropriate diagnosis. Either way, if someone's self-induced vomiting, if they're engaging in laxative abuse, if they're exercising excessively, they have an eating disorder one way or the other, regardless of what the diagnosis is. And eating disorders themselves, irrespective of diagnosis, are very significant illnesses.
Right. Now, if a person is forcing themselves to throw up, I mean, you know, there are people that would think, well, you know, they're keeping all those calories away or keeping all that fat out of their system. Now, does this also mean they're also keeping all the nutrients or minerals that they need as well?
actually they're losing more minerals and nutrients than they are calories, because self-induced vomiting is not the best form of weight control.
Wow.
People think that it is, but actually the body absorbs a great number of calories in the beginning stages of digestion, so it's not the greatest form of weight control. But they do end up losing a lot of essential nutrients. Electrolytes can be out of balance. And self-induced vomiting is one of the symptoms that can end up leading to severe medical complications, including cardiac arrest and death.
Wow.
Very serious illnesses, and I don't think people realize how serious. Anorexia nervosa has the highest premature death rate of any mental illness. So greater than depression, greater than bipolar illness, it's a significant killer. And I think that sometimes we see people who might look great on the outside, might seem to just be trying to diet excessively and just maybe have gone a little bit too far, but people don't realize how significant the medical complications are of eating disorders.
Okay. Now, how is the diagnosis determined? Is there a specific thing and I realize that a doctor can probably do that, but how can we as parents take a look at that and go, I think my child falls into that category?
Well, those are the great questions. Actually, there's two questions there that I'm going to answer. The first is about how to diagnose an eating disorder.
Okay.
And a physician or else a mental health worker can diagnose an eating disorder, and it's based on a few distinct characteristics that we look for. You know, it's not like you go in and take an eating disorder test. It's not like you get an X-ray or you get a blood test just to see if you have an eating disorder. We look for specific signs and symptoms. One of the symptoms for anorexia is a significant amount of weight loss. The other is an intense fear of gaining weight. And actually, anyone with an eating disorder will have this intense fear of gaining weight, even if they're already underweight. And the other characteristic that goes along with it is a body image distortion, where someone with anorexia, even if they look emaciated, will see their bodies differently than others see their bodies. So they might think of themselves as fat, even if they're very underweight, because there's a distortion in the way they perceive their own body image.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we see these characteristics, and then also in women, another marker is amenorrhea, which is a loss of menstruation for at least 3-month period of time. When we see these markers, then someone is diagnosed with anorexia. But parents might not necessarily be able to see these same signs and symptoms if their child doesn't report to them that they have a fear of gaining weight, if the child perhaps hides the amount of weight that they've lost, if a parent doesn't know whether or not their young daughter has ceased menstruation, they might not recognize these signs or symptoms. So there's other things that parents can look for. For example, increased social isolation, irritability, moodiness. These things come along with significant weight loss. Ritualistic habits around food. You know, maybe someone eats only at a certain time of day. They eat only certain kinds of foods. They might eat by themselves and not be comfortable eating around other people. And then things that we might look for that sound almost like you have to be hypervigilant, but you know, you might notice a pattern. For example, if your child gets up from the dinner table very frequently right after eating and goes to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want to make too much out of little things, but it can be a symptom, a sign that maybe some self-induced vomiting is going on.
Now, how are drugs tied into this? Because I know in many cases with some of the kids that we're working with, you know, the parents or the professionals working with them will say that, you know, they've been taking a lot of speed or a derivative of speed, you know, speed, cocaine, something that speeds up your system. Does that tie in as well? Because it certainly ties into the weight loss.
It certainly can. People with eating disorders often misuse prescription drugs and illicit drugs and even over-the-counter herbal drugs in order to increase the amount of weight that they lose. And we know that about 1 to 2/3 of people with bulimia end up also having a co-occurring substance abuse problem. It's a little bit less for anorexia. There's sort of two subtypes with anorexia. One is called a restricting type, and that's a person who just doesn't eat a lot of calories.
Mm-hmm.
The other is the binge purge type, where we see the behaviors that mimic bulimia, very similar to bulimia. And substance abuse actually occurs more with the anorexia patients who have the binge purge type and less in those who have the restricting type. But it still is a significant problem in a large percentage of those with eating disorders.
Wow. Now you mentioned about the fact that there's actually, people dying of it. I mean, are there statistics in regards to that? Because you said it's more than most any other mental illness.
Yes, unfortunately, it's a very frightening statistic that up to 20% of those who are diagnosed with anorexia will die from the illness. And mostly,
oh, wow.
it's very disturbing, and it's mostly a result of starvation that comes from anorexia. However, there's also a large percentage of people with anorexia who commit suicide. The suicide rate for those with anorexia is 57 times higher than in the general population. So we're talking about, obviously, co-occurring issues like depression and anxiety and things that can cause mood disturbance, but the symptoms themselves of anorexia are very disconcerting, not only for family members, but for the patients themselves.
Now, from a psychological standpoint, which is considered primary and which is considered secondary? For instance, with depression, what is it generally that depression is primary and the anorexia is secondary, or is it vice versa?
You know, that can be sort of difficult to determine, but there can be co-occurring issues. So there might be someone with an eating disorder who has co-occurring depression. Sometimes the depression is what we see first and then an eating disorder follows. Sometimes depression can come after the onset of an eating disorder. But there are frequent illnesses that co-occur with eating disorders, like depression, like anxiety disorders. With anorexia, we see a high percentage of attention deficit disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder is something that also co-occurs with eating disorders. So there are a number of illnesses that co-occur with anorexia.
Well, now, with some of these that you work with in psychotherapy, I mean, how would you approach that if you had, for instance, like a dual diagnosis and you're looking at two things? You know, are you going to go after the depression in hopes that once you've solved that, or not solved it, but you know what I mean, once you've worked on that particular issue, is there a good chance that the anorexia is going to fade? Or at this point, because of the possible death, are you going to focus on the anorexia and follow with the depression?
That's a great question, and it does depend on the kind of eating disorder that's diagnosed. But with anorexia, what you need to treat first is the weight loss, the malnutrition. Because it's very interesting, we know from studies that many of the symptoms of anorexia do go away once weight is restored. So whether it's mood changes, irritability, social isolation, even cognitive difficulties like attention and concentration problems, many of those symptoms go away when the weight is restored. And the other thing about anorexia is certain medications like antidepressants don't seem to work when someone is underweight. So we wait until someone has restored their weight to a healthy range. Then they'll be prescribed medication if it's appropriate to deal with whatever underlying issues might be there, like anxiety or depression. But it differs if someone has a different eating disorder like bulimia, where both issues might be treated at the same time.
Wow. You brought up an interesting point that I had never thought of, and that is that somebody can actually be so malnutritioned, is that the right word?
Malnourished, yeah.
Malnourished.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can be so malnourished that the medications that they're taking aren't going to be effective?
That's right.
And I would have almost thought it was the opposite, that I would be afraid that there would be so little left of them that the medications they would take might overdose them. But, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of it.
There aren't really a lot of medications that are effective for anorexia. There are certain anti-anxiety medications that can be helpful on a short-term basis, especially if someone really has anxiety around mealtime. They just can't seem to reduce their anxiety enough to be able to take in any food. There are some anxiety medications on a short-term basis that can be helpful. And there are new medications that are called atypical antipsychotic medications, which actually help to reduce the agitation that people can have sometimes with anorexia and also encourage a little bit of weight gain. So those are new medications that are prescribed off-label. They're not approved by the FDA for that specific purpose, but studies recently have shown that there's some moderate benefit for anorexia. But it is a little bit frustrating for professionals when there's not a great medication that helps with this disorder until weight is restored. So the first thing we do with anorexia is try to get that weight restored to a healthy weight range.
Now, how tough is that when someone has gone this long, doing everything they can not to put on weight?
It's a tough thing to do, you know, especially if someone doesn't really see that they have a problem, or if the symptoms themselves aren't uncomfortable for the patient. So, for example, we see that it sometimes is easier to get someone with bulimia into treatment because the symptoms are uncomfortable. They don't really like to be making themselves throw up. They don't really like to have binge episodes where they eat an uncontrollable amount of food in a short period of time. It's very uncomfortable. But with anorexia, sometimes the symptoms are not necessarily unwanted. People might sort of appreciate the fact that they can go a long time without eating. It's not uncomfortable. It becomes almost a badge of honor, a source of pride. So it can be difficult to get them interested in treatment. So it's difficult to do, and there are sort of new approaches that families are taking to try to encourage weight gain, even within the home, so that if someone doesn't want to go to the hospital, doesn't want to go to treatment, there are new approaches to try to encourage weight gain even within the home.
All right. Now, I realize it may be a stereotype, but is this something that is still a much bigger problem with girls or females than it is with boys?
Well, that's an important question because you're right. The preponderance of patients with anorexia are female. About 85% are female. So we see about 10 to 15% in males. However, the fastest increasing population, the fastest growing population with anorexia is teenage boys.
Wow.
And what we find is that a lot of boys and young men are kind of afraid and embarrassed to tell someone that they think they might have an eating disorder because they think of it as a female disease. So that stereotype that you talked about can get in the way when a young boy has an eating disorder. So we see this the sort of the landscape of anorexia changing over time and increasing in males, but it still is primarily a female disorder.
Right. But it also sounds like it's already increasing, they're just not coming forward.
That's very true.
So it's skewing the statistics, I guess.
It is. It's hard to know exactly how many people have anorexia because they don't all come forward for treatment and for diagnosis. And that's true for both males and females.
Now, maybe more so with the males, but also with both genders. Do you think a lot of this is coming out of a lot of the pressures that come from like high school athletics? Is there a greater percentage of athletes that are dealing with these problems?
There is. There is a higher rate of eating disorders among athletes. We know, for example, among female collegiate athletes that the rate of eating disorders is about one-third. That's far higher than in the general population. And there are certain factors with athletes that sort of put them at higher risk. For example, some of the personality characteristics that we see in athletes, like determination and perfectionism and high standards, high self-standards, sometimes make it difficult for someone with an eating disorder to think about changing their ways. They become almost determined in their behaviors. So some personality characteristics we see sometimes contribute to the higher rate of eating disorders in athletes. But we also know that sometimes peer behaviors are kind of encouraging eating disordered behaviors. For example, with male athletes, sometimes with wrestling, we know that right. There's pressure for males to make their weight
make
class.
Weight, yep.
You know, either to eat a lot of food in a short period of time to make the higher weight class, or sometimes to engage in self-induced vomiting or laxative abuse or intense sauna treatments in order to try to lose weight in a rapid pace.
Well, and I can remember that. I mean, going back to wrestling days, and you had the starve yourself right before your weigh-in so that you make weight. And then, I mean, within that same day, you know, turn around and go to another room and eat as much calories as you possibly can so that you'll have the energy to get through your wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very bizarre thing to do. But I remember doing it, and I know that, and I have a son who was just in wrestling, and, you know, I was kind of paying attention, and just to make sure that that wasn't an issue with him, you know, and I told him, I said, you're growing.
Good
and as
you.
And as you're growing, if it means that you're going to go into another weight class, just go into another weight class. Don't try to stay in that one.
Good for you. And I think that's the balanced approach that parents and coaches also need to have. You know, sometimes there can be this misconception that if an athlete is performing well in their sport or if they have a lot of energy, they must be doing okay. Even if they've struggled with an eating disorder or may even have an eating disorder, they must be okay if they can perform well. But actually, that's really a misconception because the damage that's being done to one's body takes place over time, and it still continues to be done even when an athlete performs at a high level. For example, one of the people who contributed to my book by telling her story was a long-distance runner who set many records and, in fact, still holds some of them today. And she was performing very well in her sport, winning races, all the while she had anorexia. So she didn't actually have her first period until she was in her 20s. And there
Wow.
was a lot of damage being done to her body. A lot of bone damage, obviously other long-term consequences because she wasn't taking in enough nutrition. You could see the effects of that, even with the sign of her not getting her period. But now, later in life, you know, she struggled with many things, many consequences that didn't go away, whether it's increased risk of fractures, infertility, a lot of other skeletal issues that she has because she didn't take care of her body. And so even though she was able to perform, she had a lot of energy, people wouldn't have recognized there was something wrong with her body. The eating disorder was still taking its toll.
Well, yeah, you're right, and especially someone to function at that level. I mean, at a championship level, you're right. I certainly wouldn't think, gee, this person is not getting what they need for their body to function.
That's right.
Pretty amazing stuff. Now, and again, I know you have a practice and you work with both, I guess, adults and young people in regards to this.
I do.
Now, I mean, tell us some stories in regards to, you know, looking at it from somebody else's view, you know, as far as, you know, what is it that they're going through? Walk us through something so that maybe the parents that are listening can also hear and see that, you know, this is when it was observed, when it was brought to you, and where it went from there.
Okay. Well, you know, the stories with eating disorders really vary. We see sometimes other severe issues going on. When, for example, I saw one woman, young woman in my practice, she was about 19 years old, who came in not for her eating disorder, but because she was engaging in cutting behavior. So she was cutting herself with a razor blade once or twice a week. And we see this actually in about a quarter of the cases of those with an eating disorder where there's cutting involved. And so she was coming in because her family was concerned that she was trying to kill herself. And she wasn't trying to kill herself. She was crying out. She was saying that she was in pain and there was a lot going on that was hurting her that she didn't know how to deal with. She didn't know how to get help with. And so she would cut when she would feel these sort of intense emotions. But something else that she did when she felt these intense emotions was that she would binge and purge. So she would eat a lot of food in a short period of time, and then she would engage in self-induced vomiting. So for her, her eating disorder, which was bulimia at the time, was kind of a signal that there were underlying issues, underlying emotions that were difficult for her to deal with. And so that's what we worked on. We worked on developing skills, one of which is called distress tolerance, which is learning how to deal with uncomfortable emotions in a healthy way. And part of recovery from an eating disorder is learning these other healthy and helpful skills that kind of help take the place of eating disordered symptoms. Because for a lot of people, symptoms of an eating disorder, although it doesn't seem to make sense to us, are actually just a way of coping with uncomfortable and intense emotions. And if someone knew another way to deal with those emotions, a healthier way to deal with those emotions, they would do that. And so with her, we spent time helping her gain those relaxation skills, distress tolerance skills, something called mindfulness, which is kind of an anxiety reduction technique where a person stays more in the moment and worries a lot less about the future and has a lot fewer regrets about the past. So we talked about these skills over time. And as she gained these skills and learned how to deal with emotions, her eating disorder symptoms subsided and her cutting behavior subsided.
Wow. Yeah, and that's, I mean, I guess I'm going to go into the thing about commercialism. I mean, how much of this do you think is magnified because of a body image that especially young girls are given on TV, that this is what you should look like?
You know, that's a really important question, Alan, because studies are showing more and more that there is a correlation between the thin ideal that we see portrayed in our Western media and eating disordered symptoms. So we know that from studies that girls who read fashion magazines and who watch shows where a thin ideal is portrayed, meaning the ideal sort of image of beauty is a very, very thin, underweight young woman, we know that when girls view these sort of images, that it does affect their own perception of their body. They think they're fat after looking at these images, where before looking at these images in the studies, they weren't thinking that way about themselves. So it has an immediate effect, seeing these images in TV and in movies and in magazines. And we also know that when a young woman has more of a negative perception of her own body image, she is more likely to engage in unhealthy eating behaviors and then potentially develop an eating disorder. So we know from studies that there is a correlation. But it's really unfortunate because what we see more and more over time is that the thin ideal is getting thinner and thinner over time. Where 20 years ago, the average model weighed about 23% less than the average American woman. Today she weighs, excuse me, I messed that statistic up. I'll back up. 20 years ago, the average model weighed about 8% less than the average American woman. Today she weighs about 23% less than the average American woman. So she's getting skinnier and skinnier all the time.
But, well, now you're saying she's getting skinnier and skinnier. Isn't that also because our society is getting fatter?
Great point. No, it's a good point. You know, the diet industry actually has its positives and its negatives in terms of its effect on how we feel about our bodies. You know, sometimes dieting can be what someone needs in order to improve their health. But oftentimes people who engage in dieting are engaging in dieting not because they need to for health-related purposes, but because they're wanting to conform to this thin ideal. And so dieting in and of itself is not always a healthy thing to engage in. And yet what we see are messages from the diet industry, from the fitness industry. Mm-hmm. You really can't get away from it. And encouraging sort of being thinner and thinner through the messages that we see. Each adolescent who watches TV watches about 5,200 attractiveness messages per year. And those attractiveness messages tell the adolescent that they should be thinner in order to be attractive. That's just being inundated with this sense of thin being beautiful. But it doesn't talk about the fact that sometimes thin is not healthy. Sometimes thin can be healthy if it's a balanced weight and if it's a thin weight that falls within a normal range. But what we're seeing today is that thin falls outside of that normal healthy weight range and ends up being in an unhealthy weight range.
Now, have doctors changed what that weight range is? And actually, before you answer that, there's a call coming in. So I'm going to take a call, which most know that I don't do very often. So let's see how well I do. Hi, you're on with Answers with the Family, and you're on with Sari Shepherd.
Yes, hi, this is Kay. I'd like to ask a question about chemicals and foods.
All right, go ahead. Go ahead, Kay.
Okay. Hey, Kay? My name is Kay, and
yes.
I have a question about the effects of chemicals in the foods and how this is affecting perhaps young women's brains and anorexia and even weight gain. I think it may have some effects on that.
You know, Kay, that's actually a really timely question because there were just some recent studies done that show that some of the chemicals that are in diet sodas that are, you know, sodas that we drink because we don't want to gain weight, actually what we know now from scientific studies done on lab rats is that the rats who consume these chemicals end up eating more than if they did not consume these chemicals. So we drink the diet soda thinking that it's going to help us to lose weight, but actually it might be that we're hungrier after drinking the diet soda than if we hadn't drank the diet soda at all. And we're just learning a little bit more about how the chemicals in some of our foods are affecting our appetites, but it seems that some of the diet foods that we consume aren't necessarily healthy for our diet or for weight loss.
Well, and it sounds like our conspiracy theorist would say that's just another way for them to sell more of their product.
Yes.
It's not just diet foods too, isn't it? Just almost anything the kids are eating, from chips to hamburgers, just preservatives they're putting in everything.
Well, there are certainly unhealthy ingredients in our foods today. For example, high fructose corn syrup we know raises what's called the glycemic index, which can lead to more rapid weight gain. We know that trans fats that are in some of our foods, like French fries and some of the foods that your adolescent might be eating, as most adolescents do, can be bad for the body and are not healthy fats to be eating. And some cities, for example, New York City, ban trans fats altogether because of the health risks associated with them. So, you know, Kay, I think you bring up a good point. Healthy eating often includes a lot of organic foods, a lot of foods without chemicals and preservatives. We don't want to go overboard and keep kids from feeling like they can enjoy any sort of snack, you know, like a candy bar or some cookies with their friends. But we do want to make sure that the kinds of foods that they eat in general are healthy foods.
Thanks so much.
All right, Kay. Thank you so much for calling.
You did great, Alan, taking the call.
Yeah, I don't do this a lot, so I'm glad that worked out way. And actually, I'm glad because that's not a question I would have thought of, but the idea of the chemicals, and you brought up a great point, you know, that the chemicals in there are actually making you hungrier or thirstier, which stimulates more of their own product.
And, you know, sometimes with these kinds of foods, like diet foods, we just have this belief that they're somehow better for us. Sugar-free foods, for example, fat-free foods, we think are better for us because they're not going to cause weight gain. But actually, sometimes when you eat fat-free foods, they have more calories than foods with fat in them. Or there can be this idea, sort of a mindset, that if you're eating something that's fat-free, you can eat more of it.
Right.
And not gain weight, when actually you end up taking in more calories.
Well, and one of the things, and I may be dating myself a little bit, but I can remember the concept of... and more so with girls that I knew, that were making the decision between smoking or not smoking based on if they will gain weight or not. So literally weighing the decision of saying, okay, I know smoking's bad for me, but I'm going to go ahead and smoke anyway because I'd rather have that health problem than to gain weight. Mm-hmm. So is that still an issue that we're dealing with now?
Absolutely. Yeah, smoking and the use of other substances, even over-the-counter products like diuretics and laxatives, can be used and abused in order to stave off weight gain. And some people think that they need to smoke in order to keep from gaining weight because they're afraid that if they stop smoking, they'll gain a lot of weight in a short period of time. And that's actually a misconception because the average amount of weight that a person gains when they stop smoking is about 5 to 7 pounds. So we're not talking about an uncontrollable amount of weight gain. But there still is this idea that if you stop smoking that you're going to gain a lot of weight. And also there's an idea that if you take herbal supplements, which are considered to be natural products, mm-hmm. that they're always healthy for you. But there are a number of herbal products, and I list some of them in my book, that people misuse because they either induce vomiting or they have a laxative effect or they have a weight loss effect. And not all of these products are actually healthy, even though they're considered natural.
Well, and that brings up a great point. There seems to be just a plethora now of products out there that are going to cleanse your system. They're going to cleanse your colon.
Right.
They're going to cleanse your system. I'm seeing it all over on as far as on the internet. I mean, I seem to get sent these things all the time. Is that something that is really helpful, or are we also potentially damaging ourselves with that as well?
Well, you're talking about the detox diet craze.
Yeah.
Yes, and they are popping up more and more, these detox diets. But we know from studies, and I hate to sort of burst anyone's bubble out there, that detox diets actually do nothing to detoxify the body. And it's better to just eat a balanced diet, drink a lot of water, and get a moderate amount of exercise in order to detoxify your body. But detox diets actually don't do anything to detoxify the body. So, you know, sometimes there are sort of these extreme detox diets we read about. A lot of celebrities do this cayenne pepper diet where they drink lemon water and they eat cayenne pepper and not much else for a few days in order to detoxify their bodies. Really what they're doing is they're engaging in a short period of self-starvation, but they're not doing anything to detoxify their bodies from toxins, chemicals, or any sort of unwanted ingredients that they had been consuming.
Well, and in fact, I mean, isn't your body possibly even just trying to hang on to everything it's got because you're not giving it anything?
That's right. When you engage in a rapid amount of weight loss, your body's going to adjust, your metabolism's going to slow down. And I think sometimes what people don't realize is that dieting isn't necessarily the way to maintain a healthy weight, because when you diet, your metabolism does slow down. It's actually better for you to adopt a healthy lifestyle. And I know that it's, you know, we hear this time and time again, but there's a reason why we do, that really moderation and a healthy approach to food and exercise is the best way to maintain a healthy weight.
So the bottom line is that work it off.
You know? Work it off, but in a balanced way. Yeah, we don't want to, you know, see a lot of increased numbers of excessive exercisers, because I do see that a lot in my practice where, for example, I talked with a woman just very recently who said that she ran 13 miles the morning before she saw me, not because she wanted to run 13 miles, but because she had eaten so much the day before, she felt like 13 miles was the minimum she would be able to run in order to burn off the food that she consumed. And so we see a lot of people engaging in excessive exercise, not because they enjoy the exercise, not because they want to engage in a pleasurable activity, but because they feel like they need to punish themselves for the food that they've eaten. Now, for some people, 13 miles might not be excessive, but for many people it is.
Yeah, it certainly would be for me. And actually, when you were saying that, I was smiling because I was thinking, I remember years ago with a group of friends, and that on the day after Thanksgiving, we had a football game that we would have, and part of the reason was that we said, okay, because we know that we're all going to have pigged out the night before or the day before, so we're going to have this football game so that we're all going to you know, get as much exercise as possible. And as we got a little bit older, what we realized were all we were doing was really beating ourselves up. It wasn't really burning off a whole lot after it was all said and done.
But that's true for many people who do engage in excessive exercise, that it can feel like a form of punishment for eating more than they would have preferred to have eaten. And dieting itself can sometimes be a form of punishment. You know, the studies show that about 35% of people who just engage in dieting end up falling into this category of what's called pathological dieting, meaning they diet for the wrong reasons or they can't seem to stop dieting. And about 25% of those end up with an eating disorder. So it just goes to show that not all dieting is healthy, and not all weight loss is for healthy reasons. So it's important, if you do engage in a weight loss program, to talk to your doctor, and if there are any unhealthy weight loss behaviors going on, that you take a closer look to see if there might not be some sort of an eating disorder involved.
That sounds great. We're going to take a quick break, but one of the questions I want to touch on when we come back to that I've heard different arguments is how many meals should we eat per day?
Okay, great.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
We're back, and you're listening to us on Answers for the Family. We are talking with Sari Shepherd, and the last question that we had to do with how many times we should eat per day. I've heard different things. I've heard people that say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to start dieting now, so instead of three a day, I'm going to have only two. And you know, then I've other people that have said, and probably more so when I was in more of a workout mode, saying, no, you want to eat at least five times a day. You know, so what is it that we should be doing, and does it vary based on our activity?
Well, for most people, they should be eating three meals a day and can include one or two snacks a day. That's really what a healthy, balanced diet looks like for most people. It does change a little bit if there's diabetes or certain other dietary issues involved, where someone might need to eat smaller meals more frequently throughout the day. But for most people, three meals a day, a couple snacks a day is a great way to go. There is an idea that if you skip breakfast, you're going to end up eating less calories throughout the day and maybe losing weight. And sometimes in the short term, that's true. But what studies show is that if you skip a meal, whether it's breakfast or lunch, you actually end up eating more than if you had eaten that meal to begin with. So it actually results in greater weight gain over time than weight loss. And so the best approach to a diet is a healthy and balanced approach where you're taking in three meals a day and sometimes giving yourself that one or two snacks as well.
All right. But in moderation.
But in moderation, of course.
Is
yes.
What you're saying. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the book before we run out of time. I did get a chance to read it. The book is called 100 Questions and Answers About Anorexia Nervosa. It was great because I really got a chance to read questions from average people, which I thought really helped. For me to learn a little bit about a subject that I wasn't that knowledgeable about. Now, why did you decide to write a book like this, and why did you take that particular approach, whereas you were going to literally put in the questions that you're getting asked and answering them?
Well, for a couple reasons. One is because anorexia is a subject that people really don't know that much about. You know, we read about celebrities who maybe have battled anorexia. Sometimes we see someone walk by who looks exceptionally thin, and we think they might have anorexia. But when it comes to understanding anorexia, most people really don't understand what it is. For example, one of the biggest misconceptions about anorexia is that it's a lifestyle choice, that someone chooses to be anorexic. Actually, anorexia is a mental illness. And so people don't understand perhaps the nature of anorexia, that is, it is a severe mental disorder, and it has severe medical consequences. And so even just helping people understand the nature of the illness was important. But when I talk with people who either have anorexia, have a loved one with anorexia, or who just want to know more about it, I'm constantly getting questions, just very practical, straightforward questions. How does somebody get treatment? You know, what are the warning signs of anorexia? Are certain behaviors something to watch out for? Is the media involved in sort of contributing to eating disorders? And so I get a lot of these questions again and again, and it seemed like the best way to approach the book was to put it in a question and answer form, because then you can go straight to the question that you want to know the most about at any given time, or you can refer back to them over time and just have the questions there in a really easy to read manner. There's not a lot of jargon here, so it's really easy for families to understand. But at the same time, it's packed full of information. So pretty much anything you want to know about anorexia is going to be in the book.
Yeah, and actually, you mentioned the part about not a lot of jargon. One of the things that I liked was is that it was not written for doctors. I mean, it was written for us.
Right.
You know, to be able to read it and go, okay, my child is going through this. Yes, that seems to fit. You know, there was questions that I thought were really geared for the average person that may not know for sure, am I going through this or am I seeing this in a child?
Well, I'm glad you thought so. And the book also includes other aspects of eating disorders that might not be related to anorexia, but that might be related to other unhealthy diet habits. For example, I have a scale to help you determine if you are an excessive exerciser. I have a scale to help you determine, it's sort of like a survey, a self-test, if you have a negative body image. And so the book not only addresses clinical forms of an eating disorder like anorexia, but it also just addresses things that 80% of women go through, as studies show in our culture, that we're unhappy with our bodies. We don't like the way that we look. And so there's things to help improve body image, questions that women can ask themselves, and information for men as well.
That's just an astronomical percentage. I mean, 80% of women not liking their body.
Not satisfied with their appearance, not liking their body. And,
okay.
and that's
well,
sad statistic.
Yeah. But see, I want to be the first male to go on record. Trust me, there's like 80% of you, I do like your body, okay? so look, there. I mean, this is a statistic that is very much askew. If you're doing this because, you know, you think that you want a male to look at your body, you know, or you want them to like what it is they see, let me tell you, we like it. Okay? I'll speak for the men. We like it. But I think what I like even more is somebody who is happy with himself, mentally and physically. So, and I think, again, you know, again, going maybe from a male perspective, is if you're happy with what it is that you have, I don't think we notice as much what it is that that you have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the fact, if you're happy with it, we're probably going to be happy with it. But if you're not happy with it, that's what we're going to see.
And you touch on something that's really important, because self-esteem issues are often prevalent with someone who has an eating disorder. And I think more so for women than for men, because part of the way our culture defines a successful woman includes her appearance. And I think that's more true for women than it is for men. Now, it's increasingly true for men over time, especially in the last decade or so. But it's still more true for women, that for a woman to feel that she's successful. And actually, there's a quote in my book taken from Parade magazine where a woman said that in order for me to feel successful, I have to have healthy kids, I have to have a great marriage, I have to have a good job, and I have to be thin. And so for many women, they feel like in order to be a great catch, perhaps, or just a successful woman, or to feel good about herself, that she has to be thin. And that's a lot of pressure for women, especially because in our culture, we don't sort of approve of a wide variety of body types as being attractive, and that's our fault. We should not have that to be the case in our culture, but we see thin people as being somehow more attractive than other body types. And I'm glad that that's changing a little bit when we see some other body types being appreciated in recent films and through recent recording artists, for example. But still, the predominance of messages that we get from the media, and sometimes from even our friends, other women, is that if you want to look attractive, if you want to be considered successful, you'll be thin.
Wow. Well, before we run out of time, I also want to make sure that people know, I mean, how can they get a hold of you if they have questions for you specifically? And if they want to get the book, where can they go to get it?
Okay. Well, I have a website that they're welcome to visit. There's some free downloadable articles about eating disorders. And that website address is www.helpforeatingdisorders.info. So not .com, but .info.
Okay.
And if they want to take a look at the book, there's information on my website. They can also get it at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders Books. And if they want to contact me and ask me any more questions about eating disorders or about the book, they can do that at the website.
Okay, that'd be great. Now, and for those of you that are driving, again, if you weren't able to write any of that down, you can contact us at answers4thefamily.com, and we will have links going directly to her site, or you can get the questions to us. We will forward them on. So one way or the other, you will get your questions answered. One of the things that you had in the book that I wanted to touch on, because it's kind of where I like to leave things, and that was support from the loved ones. Mm-hmm. How important is the support from the loved ones when somebody is going through this problem?
Both support for and from loved ones are important. Absolutely, because caring for someone with anorexia, studies show, can be just as stressful as caring for someone with a chronic illness. So it really takes its toll on families. So it's important for families themselves to get support, whether that's from their clergy person or from friends or from a therapist or from their doctor. It's important for families themselves to have support and to make sure that all family members feel like they're getting a sufficient amount of attention, so that if there's one sibling with an eating disorder, parents just do their best to make sure that they give enough attention and love to the other siblings, and that parents make sure to do enough to find support for themselves, whether that's, you know, take a night out by themselves each week, or whether it's to spend time with friends just talking about their own feelings, because parents go through a lot when they have a child with an eating disorder. But support from the family is also important. And as a matter of fact, when it comes to an adolescent with an eating disorder, the best success rates come when families are involved in that eating disorder recovery. So if parents can get involved by going with the child to the therapist, by helping them to restore their weight at home and getting involved in that process, getting a treatment team together which the pediatrician can help with or a therapist can help with, includes a doctor, a dietitian, a mental health worker. And when the parents get involved in that recovery process, the recovery rates are the best.
Well, and you touched on something that I want to go back to, because I think it's really important, and that had to do with the other siblings. And not just with this particular issue, but anything. I mean, if there is any disease in the family, if there is a drug issue, whatever it is, I love the fact that you touched on, make sure that you are showing attention to the rest of the siblings, because unfortunately, as I think you know, it can draw in a situation to where they then start getting some other symptoms of something just to get attention.
That's right. Yeah, it can encourage what's called acting out, where, as you mentioned, it's sort of a way of getting attention or letting the parents know, hey, I'm still here. Don't forget about me. And sometimes so much energy and so much time and even financially so much money spent toward treatment can be going toward the child with an eating disorder, with any kind of serious illness, that the other children can feel a little bit left out, a little bit neglected. And so for parents, just to make sure to give the hugs, to say the I love yous, to spend time going to the Little League games or the after school activities, just to show the other children that they haven't been forgotten. And also just to talk to those other siblings about how they're feeling, that their sibling has an eating disorder, that, you know, they're watching their sibling sort of waste away and lose a lot of weight. Obviously, that's going to have some significant effect on the other siblings. So just to be able to talk about it. And as with everything I'm sure you talk about on the show, open communication is the best way to go with all of that.
Well, I certainly thank you for sharing that, but for sharing the entire subject. And from my standpoint, again, it was something that I'm not that knowledgeable about, and I don't know that a lot of men are. So I think getting the information out, getting it out to not only professionals but to the families themselves, I think is great. Putting together a book that literally is questions and answers, I mean, it just couldn't get much more simpler than that. So, Sari, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate being here.
All right. Thanks again. Bye.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
There's something about the way you try to live.